Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 19th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how corals detect moonlight, learning about your family's past with genetic ancestry testing, finding the perfect spot for that new international science facility, and the composition of solar wind. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Where did our circadian clock come from? Responding to light and dark may have happened first in the oceans, where creatures would avoid harsh ultraviolet light by going deeper into the water. But what about primitive creatures like corals, which have no eyes and cannot move, but still respond to light and dark? Well, that's been a mystery. And in a paper in this week's Science, a group of researchers working at the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia have found that the answer to that mystery lies in cryptochromes, or blue light photoreceptors. I spoke with Ulf Holt-Gudberg from Australia. He's the senior author of the paper and heads up the University of Queensland lab where much of the work took place.
Well, it's a well-known phenomenon that corals, and indeed a whole series of eyeless invertebrates, respond to very subtle changes in light but don't have eyes. And so there has been some interest in how they tune their behavior to things like the moon. Now, on the Great Barrier Reef, we've got this incredible phenomenon that happens every year where hundreds of species of coral and indeed other invertebrates spawn within a few hours of each other on a couple of nights of the year. Now, how they do that has been somewhat of a mystery until now.
Well, before we get to that, why is this mass spawning important for the survival of the reef-building corals?
The advantages of spawning together are that you swamp the predator pool. It's thought that one of the hazards of having your eggs drift away from you, as they do with corals and lots of other invertebrates, is that there's a lot of hungry mouths out there waiting to wolf them down. Now, if you get together and spawn all at once, you can actually swamp the predators. There's not enough predators to gobble up all the eggs as they come off. And so this is thought to be a major driver for this mass spawning that we see on the Great Barrier Reef each year.
It sounds like this was more than just something that involves the circadian clock.
Mass spawning probably involves a whole series of signals and processes. The first thing that happens is that temperature probably regulates the broad part of the year in which spawning occurs. And this is simply due to the fact that you need to have warm conditions to speed up your gametogenesis, or the production of eggs and sperm. And so over the year, as the temperatures warm, the gonads of corals mature. Now, as they come close to the time when they want to spawn, which is just before food becomes available and you have this high productivity on the Great Barrier Reef over the austral summer, they need to now start to coordinate essentially with the tides. Now, the best signal that they can find for that, of course, is the moon, which is driving the tides in the first place. And that's where the entraining of behavior becomes important. And they're using the blue, faint light of the moon to essentially entrain biological processes, which then finally prepare the eggs and sperm and so on, ready for release from the coral polyp. So it's really a combination of a number of mechanisms and processes that are involved. Now, cryptochromes, it appears, look like the smoking gun for the mechanism by which you tune yourself to the faint blue light of the moon.
That was your hypothesis going in, then?
That's right. And in fact, when you look across the animal kingdom, from fruit flies to humans to mice, you find that cryptochromes are involved in very similar sorts of processes where you've got the tuning of behavior and physiology to light levels. And it looks like a precursor to an ancient system, if you like, a precursor to eyes, you know, which were used for a lot more other functions. And so what we're seeing here is that, in fact, this is where Dr. Oren Levy came to my lab from Israel on a Marie Curie scholarship. He had the hypothesis that the same sorts of molecules would be involved in entraining corals to moonlight, as you saw in other parts of the animal kingdom. And so he teamed up with my lab and some other labs at Stanford and so on, and we started to track down the genes. And lo and behold, there they were.
So exactly how did the team test this hypothesis that it was these particular photoreceptors?
Well, the first thing was to demonstrate that the genes, in fact, occurred in corals. And at that point, they hadn't really been found in simple invertebrates. Now, what the team did was to design primers to conserve parts of the known molecules from mice and fruit flies, and then to use those to track down the molecules within the gene set of corals. And that is where they actually then were able to prime out some candidate molecules. Now, when they sequenced those, they found that they fell right in amongst the known cryptochrome genes. And by that, we knew that there were genes in these things. Now, the second thing is that you need to show those genes are functional. And that was where the expression was followed by a number of different techniques, where you look at the expression of the genes as a function of things like whether it's a moonlit night or a new moon night, low light. And we found that these genes were oscillating in concert with moonlight, with the lunar cycle. And that essentially was starting to piece together a puzzle that made them look like they were, in fact, candidates. The last thing that we did was to then look at where they're found within the cell. And for this, antibodies were made and then targeted against material like the larvae of corals and, in fact, the coral epidermis. And we found that these molecules are occurring and are expressed in ectoderm, which is the outer layer of tissue, which makes all the sense in the world if they're there to detect light and to respond to light. And so that picture then built up essentially the argument that cryptochromes were yet again involved in entraining clocks within, in this case, the simplest multicellular organism on the planet. And it gave us clues essentially that these molecules have been in the animal kingdom right from the start.
Now, what's your team's take on how these photoreceptors evolved?
One of the hypotheses goes back to the very beginnings of life on the planet. And this is the notion that life probably developed first, at least evolution started to take off, in the deep layers of the ocean. Now, the reason for that was that at the time when we didn't have a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere and thereby we didn't have an ozone layer, there was an extreme levels of ultraviolet radiation raining down on the planet. So if you were not protected by a sheet of water, it was a very hard life indeed. In fact, you couldn't survive. So it's thought that there might have been the first creatures that started to migrate between the deep and the shallows, mainly coming up at nighttime to feed on, say, you know, food that was developing in the upper layers of the ocean. There's the possibility that these things were allowing organisms to time their behavior such that they could migrate during the dark hours of the day. And then by the time light was starting to increase again, they could then migrate down into the deeper layers of the ocean and be protected from UV. So we don't know that for a fact. And in fact, a nice piece of speculation, but it certainly would make sense that these molecules were involved in entraining animal behavior to make sure that animals didn't end up in the wrong spot at the wrong time, and in this case, receiving too much ultraviolet radiation.
With that metaphor of the clock, this is sort of one of the primary gears, it sounds like.
Absolutely. This appears to be one of those fundamental mechanisms which probably started in cells way back in the Precambrian ooze, but now has become a very sophisticated timing mechanism, essentially the Swiss clock for the animal kingdom.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for calling and giving me this opportunity.
Ulf Hoegh-Guldberg is senior author of a paper on how corals sense moonlight. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, the limits of genetic ancestry testing. The practice of using genetics to find out one's family history has become very popular, and some people take the results of these tests seriously. That worries some scientists. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Deborah Bolnick and colleagues note that these commercially available tests don't necessarily give people the accuracy that they seek. I spoke with Bolnick from her office at the University of Texas at Austin.
In this piece, we're looking at a number of commercially available genetic tests that have become very popular in the last 10 years or so. And these are tests that are sold. They cost anywhere from $100 to $900, and consumers will use them to try to identify their biological relatives or to validate holes in their family trees, for example, and to just get more information about their genetic ancestry. these tests can give a lot of information to people, but there are also a number of limitations and assumptions that underlie the test that are not always made clear to consumers. And so in this piece, we're looking at what many of those limitations and assumptions are. And we think that it's important that both consumers and scientists realize that these tests can be problematic in some ways. They can be less informative than many people realize. And it's important for the scientific community to make clear what the issues are with these tests, what they can and cannot tell test takers.
Does the practice of taking these tests present any concerns to the scientific community?
I think some of the concerns that I see with this is, in many cases, the companies don't necessarily explain all of the limitations and the assumptions that underlie the tests. And the effect in many cases is to reify the idea that race or social identity has a genetic basis to it, and that's something that I think scientists should be concerned about. In addition, there are also some consumers who are thinking about these tests, thinking about their results in connection to medical conditions or diseases, because they know that there is some connection between ancestry and medical conditions. And so they may be asking doctors in a clinical setting to take their genetic ancestry test results into consideration when making a diagnosis or determining a treatment. And that's something that should be of concern to doctors, or it could be problematic because the tests are sometimes inaccurate. They may occasionally not be completely informative in the situation that the doctor is thinking about.
So how informative are these tests about genetic ancestry? They're not full genetic maps, are they?
No, what they're really doing is most of the tests are only looking at a very small portion of your genome. They're looking at less than 1% of the test taker's DNA in most cases. And mitochondrial DNA tests are ones that will trace DNA that's been inherited directly from one's mother's 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 line. Y chromosome tests will look at DNA inherited from the direct paternal ancestor, a man's father's father's father, for example. And so what they're really doing is they can tell you something about the genetic makeup of that one ancestor, that one lineage in your family tree. But they can't tell you about most of the DNA in your genome or most of the DNA that you've inherited from any of your ancestors. The result of this is that you can learn something about where that one particular ancestor each generation came from, because there are geographic patterns to the DNA. So you can learn approximately what part of the world there are other people who possess the same genetic markers. But it's not going to tell you exactly where, say, in Europe, your great-great-grandfather lived, for certain, nor will it be able to tell you exactly what social group or ethnic group he identified as being part of.
Now, are there any tests that get at both parents' lines?
There is, yes. There's one type of test that's sold by the company DNA Print, and this is the Ancestry by DNA test. And that test looks at about 175 different autosomal markers, and these are genetic markers that are inherited from both your mother and your father. And so they attempt to provide a better estimate of your overall ancestry. But there are also some problems with that test because we're not always certain about what evolutionary forces have shaped the frequencies and the history of the particular markers that are looked at. So some markers may reflect ancestry, but other markers may also reflect some other evolutionary processes, such as natural selection.
Are there any particular examples where the commercially available tests were inaccurate?
I know of some cases. It's not something where one can say for absolute certain that the test is wrong. But what this Ancestry by DNA test shows is that oftentimes it suggests that many people from the Middle East, from the Mediterranean region of Europe, and from some parts of India have Native American ancestry, that they seem to show what the test identifies as Native American alleles. There's really no other scientific evidence, there's no other genetic evidence or archaeological evidence that Native Americans moved from the Americas to those other parts of the world to contribute ancestry to those individuals. So it seems very strange that this test would give that result. And in all likelihood, the test is probably considering some genetic marker, some allele, to be diagnostic of Native American ancestry, when in actuality it's something that was found more widely throughout the world and predates the divergence of Native American and Eurasian populations.
say, when the Native Americans were thought to come across the land route from Alaska.
Yeah, so, I mean, my guess would be that there may be some markers that evolved and were present in the ancestral population, so before Native Americans, the ancestors of Native Americans moved into the Americas. They may have been present, and so there were particular alleles that were found in the people who became the ancestors of today's Native American populations, as well as the ancestors of some people who are now found in India and some people who now live in the Middle East and Southern Europe.
Now, how many people have taken these tests?
I don't know a precise number, because not every company has that information available. I know that there have been some studies that have tried to look at this, and over the last 6 years or so, there's been probably about 500,000 people who have taken these tests from one company or another.
Does it make a difference as to whether people use one company or another?
It may make a difference, and on one level, it may make a difference just depending on whether the company does the laboratory analyses correctly. I don't know of any cases where companies have not done laboratory analyses correctly, but it's certainly possible that that could happen at some point in time, and that could affect results. The other thing that can factor into it is that when you get an individual, a test taker's DNA sequence back, that DNA sequence is then compared with a database of samples taken from people who live around the world to look and see where there are other individuals who have the same DNA sequence or the same set of genetic markers. And the results that you get are therefore going to depend on what samples are found in a company's database. So if a database, say, has only 10 samples from one particular population, it may miss out on much of the diversity that's found in that population. And so they might tell someone, you don't share any ancestors with people from this particular population, when in fact, maybe they do, and those people they are related to simply don't have DNA samples that have made it into the particular company's database. If they sent their sample to a different company that perhaps had more samples from that population, they might then get a different result.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah Bolnick is lead author of A Policy Forum on the Limits of Genetic Ancestry Testing. Read more about it in this week's Science. Decisions about where to locate enormous international science facilities have been influenced by everything from local taxes to terrorist hijackings. In this week's Science, Daniel Cleary looks at some of the more famous of these decisions, including the decision to locate CERN in Geneva some 50 years ago, which literally provoked a fistfight. He also reports on what experts say scientists and politicians can do to avoid such calamities now and in the future. I spoke with Cleary from his home office in England.
International collaborations can get into difficulties when they have to decide where to put the new facility that they're planning to build. Because when you've got different countries working together, often they all, or more than one of them, will want to be the home of that new facility. And unless there's an easy way to decide between them, that can sometimes lead to, I don't know about hostility, but certainly a bit of tension between the collaborating countries.
Is there a new international project coming up now? Or?
There are several that are coming up to that process. The International Linear Collider is probably the biggest one, which is going to be a collaboration of quite a few countries. But principally, it's the European Union, the United States and Japan, though I think China is also a member. But that's going to be a tricky one because it's got to be on one continent, but you know, they probably all would like to have it.
Are there any international collaborations that have gone particularly well that countries may be able to pattern their new deliberations on?
There have, but usually it works well if there's an obvious place where you need to put your facility. You know, an example is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is a very large radio telescope array, which they're building in Chile. And it's a collaboration between a number of European countries and the United States and Japan, again. But in an astronomy situation, you have to go for the best viewing conditions. And Chile had the best site, you know, a large plain very high up in a desert, very dry air. And so there was no argument between the members about where to put it because they would get the best results if they put it there.
Now, was Chile one of the sponsoring countries of this project?
I don't think they contribute. They get some observing time because they, you know, donate land and other facilities, but I don't think they put a lot of money into it.
What about if the site is not obvious and several places would do just as well?
Then it's trickier because then you get into a competition situation. You know, a prime example would be CERN, which everyone thinks of now as a, you know, shining example of international collaboration. But when it was set up in the 1950s, there were several countries who wanted to host it. And they had a committee that visited them all, and eventually they came to a decision on Geneva, which is where it now is, but the people of Geneva weren't entirely happy about it at the time, and there were some politicians that opposed it very vigorously, and after a city council meeting at one point, there were fistfights in the corridors between rival politicians all over this laboratory.
Wow. Well, is that kind of turmoil to be expected in the future?
It doesn't usually get to that stage nowadays. So more recently, the ITER fusion reactor, what they had to decide where to put that. Two sites were in France, so the European Union was one sponsor, and Japan was the other. And international relations between those two members of the collaboration became very tense for about 18 months, and there was a lot of shuttle diplomacy between those two places.
So that's what mediators or experts in these kinds of disputes would advise, just doing a lot of shuttle diplomacy?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there were civil servants in the European Union and Brussels, and, you know, people from the science ministry in Japan really were doing that, and some senior scientists as well were doing all this toing and froing and heated discussions in closed rooms.
Are there any really unusual circumstances that have led to one site being chosen over another?
Well, probably the most unusual was the case of Joint European Torus, which was a fusion reactor being designed in the 1970s. And the United Kingdom had one site where they wanted to build it, and Germany had another. And the two countries couldn't come to an agreement with all the other European countries who were also sponsoring this reactor. And in the end, it boiled down to the result of a hijacking, which took place in 1977, where a German airliner was hijacked by terrorists and flown to Africa, to Mogadishu. And British special forces helped them help the Germans to storm the plane and resolve the crisis. And the German chancellor was so pleased with that he agreed to let Britain have the site of this reactor.
A little quid pro quo.
Absolutely.
So there's no real scientific process to choose the location of a scientific facility. Is that right?
There can be. Sometimes you can do it if you define the terms in advance. You know, some smaller collaborations have said, you know, we need this and this and this from a site. And so they set up a committee and they will assess each site, you know, in a sort of systematic way, and they can come to a conclusion. But you need all the members to commit to that process at the beginning so that they agree that they're going to go by these criteria and they will accept the decision of the committee at the end. And that has been done, but with a very big and expensive facility, it's sometimes hard to get people to agree to play by the rules.
The bigger the stakes, the more likely the dispute.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much for sharing this story with us. I really appreciate it.
Okay, it was a pleasure.
Science News writer Daniel Cleary reports on locating international facilities. Read more about it in this week's Science. What is solar wind made of? Scientists describe it as the stream of charged particles that's ejected from the sun's atmosphere into space. But what is it actually made of? It's an important question to answer for scientists studying the solar nebula, from which Earth and other planets formed more than 4.5 billion years ago. In a paper in this week's Science, Alex Meshick and colleagues offer some insights based on direct examination of samples of the solar wind and its isotopic composition. They got the samples from the ill-fated NASA Genesis craft, which crashed on its return trip to Earth in 2004. I spoke with Meshek from Washington University in St. Louis.
The purpose of this mission was to collect solar wind. Why we care? Because sun is our starting material on the solar system, and we don't know exactly what this starting material was. Without knowing this, we cannot exactly figure out how our planets evolved and all these things. So this mission was launched, and basically this paper we will talk about is the first paper which shows the result. Some mission, general mission goal was achieved. I think why is this important? Because of the last time we had public conversation when the return capsule crashed in Utah. And when I now talk to someone and say that I'm working for Genesis mission, everybody ask, I know, this is the one which crashed. So we still, in spite of that, we will be able to recover the whole information about solar wind, at least for noble gases.
So not all the samples were lost then?
No, absolutely not. It's just make this hard landing or crash, whatever you wish to call it, just make our work more difficult. But solar wind is there.
There have been several other probes, and there still is at least one probe still up there gathering data about the sun and our origins. How is Genesis different?
We do it in the much higher precision because they record current data, and we have collected all ions for 2 years and then analyze it in one shot. So we certainly have better statistics, and we have very, very precise data. We can figure out tiny differences in different regimes, solar regimes, and so on.
Well, what data were you able to gather from the spacecraft?
Basically, what Genesis did, it exposed to the solar wind various solar wind collectors, which were tiny films of different super pure metal deposited on sapphire. And when they arrived back to the Earth and get to our hands, we just scrub this surface layer from the sapphire with the laser in high vacuum and analyzing the mass spectrometer. So we have integrated result from 2 years of correction. And so far, what we show that, first of all, we get very precise argon isotopic composition of the sun.
What did they show?
After these measurements, we can say for sure that terrestrial atmospheric argon and solar argon are different. And for example, if we compare to Venusian atmosphere and solar wind argon are almost the same. So this just tells us that the Earth probably has something in the history which make it different from the Venus. And this is most probably earlier loss of terrestrial atmosphere due to the giant impact. Maybe this was the event which formed the moon. This is just one of the examples how argon data could be applied to the planetary science.
Were there different types of data gathered, different types of solar wind?
Yes. There is several different regimes, so-called regimes, when the solar wind, which is basically extension of the solar corona, have different speed. And Genesis spacecraft collected solar wind from specifically from different regimes. Low-speed solar wind. This is the main mode of solar wind. High-speed solar wind and so-called coronal mass ejection. This is a spectacular event of plasma ejection from the sun. And we collect them separately. And we were able to analyze them separately. And we compare all of them. And we figure out that they are not different. At least we cannot see any difference. And this basically tells us that solar wind represent very well the composition of the solar corona. Because one question was, okay, we measure solar wind, but how it's related to the sun? Maybe this is not the same thing. So we probably answer this question. At least we set some limit on how much they could be different.
What does that say about the formation of Earth separate from Venus?
It doesn't set yet any definite how the Earth was formed, but at least it can sort out some theories about that. You know, the main problem is that noble gases of terrestrial atmosphere, isotopically, different from those from the sun. And now we see it with high precision. And there are several different models and approaches which attempted to explain that. And to verify if these models are correct or not, we have to know the composition of the sun. And this is what we tried to accomplish.
So is the next step then to put another probe up there and hopefully recover this one a little bit better this time?
No, we still have a good samples to work with. Heavy noble gases will be very informative, and oxygen and nitrogen, two groups are working very hard. It's contaminated for nitrogen, for oxygen, but it's only problem how we can recover this. So the mission was successful in spite of this crash.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Alex Meshek is lead author of a paper on the composition of solar wind. Read the paper and a related perspective on the topic in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news service, Science Now, joins us for our usual roundup of other recent stories. So, David, what do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We'll talk about the power of gossip, for good and for bad, how a single protein could explain why the 1918 flu outbreak was so deadly, and finally, I'll tell you about how one of the most famous objects in the night sky just got a little bit closer.
Well, can't wait to talk about that. But what's with these rumors?
Well, Rob, as you know, gossip can be both good and bad. Scientists say gossip's good because it enforces group norms and strengthens social bonds. People feel more connected to others when they gossip. But obviously, gossip can also be bad. People tend to gossip about more powerful figures in relation to them, and is sort of a way of maybe bringing them down to earth a little bit.
The ugly rumor mill, as it were.
The ugly rumor mill, right. And gossip can hurt reputations, obviously. So a group of researchers in Germany wanted to figure out just how seriously people take gossip. So they did an interesting experiment where they took a group of 9 students, they sat them down in a room where they couldn't see each other, and they all were communicating with each other with laptops. And they played a money game where some students were supposed to give others money, or they had the choice to give other students in the group money or not give them money. And this went on for several rounds. And as the rounds went on, the students were supposed to comment on each other. They said, you know, such and such student is really generous. He gave me a lot of money. Or this such other student is a nasty miser. He wouldn't give me any of his money. And then on further rounds, the researchers introduced some gossip that they made up about certain students, about whether they were more loose with their money or more tight with their money, and so on and so forth. And at the end of the experiment, the researchers asked the students to evaluate the gossip that they had gathered on particular students versus what the students actually did. So the gossip wasn't always true. Sometimes the students actually were giving a lot of money, but the researchers planted gossip that said, hey, this guy or this girl is not giving a lot of money. And what they found was the students actually took the gossip more seriously than the truth. So if the gossip said such and such is a miserly person, even though their transaction record indicate that they were giving away a lot of money, the students still took the gossip more seriously.
Well, that's something that politicians have known about for some time, it sounds like.
Right. And what the study is basically saying is that people might adjust their own views to the views and perceptions of others, adjusting to views rather than adjusting to facts.
Well, from spreading rumors to spreading viruses, what's up with the flu?
Right. So this story concerns the 1918 influenza epidemic, which was the deadliest flu outbreak the world has ever seen. It killed about 40 to 100 million people. A lot of people died of the virus itself, but many more died of pneumonia. The virus caused damage to the lungs, and that made their lungs much more susceptible to bacteria and whatnot. So it was a really nasty flu. And ever since then, scientists have been trying to figure out what made that flu different from the flus that go around every year. Why was this flu so deadly? And in this current study, researchers focused on a protein known as PB1F2. And that's a protein that's found in a variety of flu viruses, but it's in different forms in different viruses.
Is it in the H5N1 virus that we've been hearing so much about recently?
Sure is. It's in the H5N1 virus, also known as bird flu. So that also made it stand out. So the researchers said, was there something special about this protein, the 1918 flu, that made the flu especially deadly?
So what'd they do?
So what they did was they replicated this PB1F2 protein that was in the 1918 flu, and they put it in a much more innocuous flu virus that usually infects mice. And what they found was when the mice were given this genetically modified virus, they developed very severe flu and died, I believe, within about 8 days when they were given the modified flu virus. And what's even more interesting is when they combined this virus with bacteria that caused pneumonia, the mice died much more rapidly of pneumonia than mice that were just given the ordinary everyday flu. So two things here. First of all, it seems to indicate that this protein is very critical, was very critical to making the 1918 outbreak so deadly. But second of all, it shows maybe how it made it deadly. Not only was the virus itself more deadly, but it seems to have been predisposed people much more to pneumonia, which was caused by bacteria that were hitting people at the same time.
But the mice died either way, right? I mean, either 8 days or 4 days. This was a sort of the second punch was the pneumonia.
Right. It was sort of a double hit. They were dying anyways because the virus was so virulent, but it also seemed to be damaging their lungs, which was making them even more susceptible to pneumonia, which they think is probably what happened in people too.
So what are researchers going to do with this information?
Well, they think they can take two things away from this. First of all, they think if they can target this particular protein with drugs, they may be able to prevent the flu or maybe treat it in certain people. But also now they know what to look for. They know that if a particular flu strain has this specific variation of this PB1F2 protein, that it may be much more deadly than another virus they would encounter. So they maybe help them to prioritize viruses in terms of how dangerous they might be to the general population.
And work on one type of inoculation over another. Is that right?
That could be true, yes.
Okay, so from something that we want to keep far away, that is the flu or super flu, to something that's getting closer in the night sky. What's happening up there?
So, Rob, this story concerns the Orion Nebula, which is one of the most famous objects in the night sky. It's just south of Orion's Belt. And researchers have been trying to figure out how far stars are away from us, and that helps them determine the star's age and how they evolved. And what they usually do is they use something called a parallax to measure distances. And very simply, what this is they compare the angle between the sun and the line of sight of a particular telescope, and they take that angle and they compare it to the same angle 6 months later when the Earth is at the opposite part of its orbit. And when they compare those two angles, they're able to measure distances.
A worldly or otherworldly application of the law of cosines.
You're the mathematician, Rob. I'll defer to you on that one. Anyway, the problem with using this method is that telescopes have technical limitations that can introduce small errors in these measurements, and even small errors can lead to huge differences in distances. So what a team of researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, wanted to do was see if they could improve the accuracy of this method. And they used the Very Long Baseline Array, which is 10 telescopes that stretch the distance from Hawaii to Puerto Rico. And when they're combined, they effectively make one giant telescope that has a collecting array that's thousands of kilometers wide. So they've got this huge telescope. They think it's about four times more accurate than you would get from using a single telescope alone. And what they did was when they used this telescope and did their parallax measurements with the distance to Orion, they found out that Orion was 1,270 light years away, which is about 20% closer than previous measurements had indicated.
So what are the implications of it being 20% closer?
Well, that means actually that because of the way we calculate the age of stars, that these stars are actually a lot older than we thought. And that will change some models of how we thought about when these stars evolved, how they formed, and things like that. No specifics on that yet, but hopefully we'll be getting more accurate data as far as that's concerned.
So a new tool to apply to the rest of the night sky as well.
Absolutely.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks very much for sharing these stories with us. And what can we see on Science Now later this week?
Well, we'll be doing stories on the link between sleep and wakefulness, talking about how elephants tell friends from foes, and finally, how Neanderthals and humans share a key language gene.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
David Graham is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 19th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.